Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 308 for March 20th, 2011. Coming up in a few minutes.
We get a lot of people coming in here that take the sort of experience of our whiskey tour because we're in Scotland, we're maybe just in Edinburgh for a few days, we don't have time to travel extensively, and we're just going to do Scotch. We don't know anything about it, but you know, we can't come to Scotland and not do something to do with Scotch. So we're really lucky, we get a lot of people that are kind of ripe for conversion.
That's Julie Hunter of the Scotch Whiskey Experience in Edinburgh. While I was in Edinburgh last week, I decided to check up on some of the Scottish capital's key whiskey destinations, including the Scotch Whiskey Experience. If you're planning a trip to Scotland this year, get a paper and pen ready for some suggestions. That's coming up along with the calendar of events, the emails of the week, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department. First, though, let's look at the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. It's only been a couple of months since three bottles of Shackleton's whiskey were returned to Scotland on White & Mackay owner VJ Malia's private jet. But it looks like master blender Richard Patterson has cracked the secret of the McKinley's blended scotch that was buried in Antarctica for more than a century. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Master of Malt's blog, and there's a link at the WhiskeyCast website, reported on Friday that White & Mackay will start selling a replica of the McKinley's blend at the end of March. 50,000 bottles will be available at £100 each, with £5 from every bottle to be donated to the Antarctic Heritage Trust. Just a few hours ago, White & Mackay spokesman Rob Bruce sent me an email confirming that they have been able to replicate the blend, but cannot confirm anything else at this time. I tracked down Richard Patterson in Las Vegas, where he's at the Universal Whiskey Experience this weekend.
Well, as everybody knows, I collected the three bottles with Dr. Malia in January from the Christchurch Antarctic Heritage Trust. And these have been brought back to Scotland and are currently, and I mean currently, and they are still in progress. They are still being thoroughly analyzed for every detail to ensure that we have the relevant information, not only taken from the first bottle, but also from the second, to verify that they are consistent in all bottles. And that's what we're doing at the present moment. But the results of these will not be released for quite some time yet, because this is not a five-minute job. We need to make sure that we have all the relevant information. And as you can imagine, the Scotch whisky industry, as well as the rest of the world, are waiting with bated breath to see what the results are. So there's no way that we're going to release anything until we're 100% positive that we have analyzed and got the relevant information that will be of severe interest, or will be of great interest to everybody out in the spirit world who are interested in this fantastic find.
So what did it taste like when you tasted it, Richard?
Well, all I can say at the present moment, it was unbelievable. It was a sensation. It was a part of my life when we actually tasted it that I will never forget as long as I live. But you'd have to wait just, you know, a few more weeks yet before I can actually really talk about it to tell you what I found, what I saw, and what I tasted that makes it so memorable. Because there are a whole barrage of questions about, you know, how is the whiskey, you know, after being in the ice for 103 years, is it stable? Is it, does it reflect something you've seen before? All these questions, you know, people are eager to inquire about, but will be, I can say, revealed very shortly. But I would like to do the whole thing in one go, because there's no point in talking about it. I've got all the information to hand, and I can assure you that just now, there are still one or two pieces of the puzzle that need to be, clarified. Because when I eventually talk about it, I certainly want to have all that information to hand. I don't want to have anything missing, because people will be asking, you know, does it really, or is it stable, and kind of whiskey and container, the cork, everything. How does it all stand up after 103 years?
And the answer is?
You'll have to wait and see.
Fair enough, Richard. Now, multiple sources have told me that Master of Malt's report is correct, but again, White & Mackay is not officially confirming it as of this weekend. I'll have more details as they're available. Again, there is a link to the Master of Malt blog report at the WhiskeyCast website. Now, Tasmania is about as close as one can get to Antarctica, and the Australian distillery that pioneered whiskey making in Tasmania has reached a deal to export its whiskies to the U.S. for the first time. Got word Saturday that Marcel Importing in Chicago has won the U.S. import rights for Lark Distillery's whiskies, and the first shipment is on the water as we speak. Marcel is better known as the owner and importer for the Speyside, King's Crest, and the Scots Selection lines of Scotch whiskies. The company will import all three of Lark's current expressions and hopes to have bottles available for a debut at Whiskey Live New York on April 6th. They should also be at Malt Advocates Whiskey Fest in Chicago, April 15th. One more note now from the Pacific Rim. David Kroll of Whiskey Magazine Japan has been collecting news on the status of Japan's distilleries following the massive earthquake and tsunami. His latest update this week is very good news. Nikkei reports no major damage to the Miyagikyo distillery and no injuries to distillery staff and their families. The Kuruazawa distillery also was not damaged, and Ichiro Akuto's Chichibu distillery reports only some minor damage to bottled stock. There's one brighter note from the Shinshu area, which has been suffering from aftershocks. The owners of the Mars distillery, which has been closed for the last 20 years, went ahead with plans to restart the distillery this week, despite the aftershocks, and will be distilling from now until April 20th. David's update doesn't have any word from Suntory, but I've been told by sources here in the U.S. that there doesn't appear to be any damage to the Suntory distilleries. Jack Daniel's has stuck to making whiskey one way for 160 years, with the occasional departure from tradition like Gentleman Jack. That's changing with an entry into the growing whiskey liqueur market. Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey combines the traditional Lynchburg whiskey with a honey-based liqueur, and will be available throughout the U.S. starting in April. I received a sample this week. I'll have tasting notes for it later in this episode. First, Isle of Arran named a whiskey in honor of the distillery's peacock, the next one for a tree at the distillery. Now the third whiskey in the Icons of Arran series is out, and dog lovers will be especially interested. The Westie is named in honor of Rory, a West Highland Terrier that lives at the distillery. The whiskey happens to be older than Rory. It's a 12-year-old. Just 6,000 bottles will be available worldwide starting in April. Island Park is expanding its travel retail range with a 1978 Vintage Collection release. While the first four releases in the Vintage Collection were all bottled at 40% ABV, this one is bottled at 47.8%. It'll sell for £300 a bottle, or around $480 at current exchange rates. The next few weeks are shaping up to be busy ones. Not only do we have several Whiskey Live events, Malt Advocates Whiskey Fest in Chicago and the Spirit of Speyside Festival in a few weeks, but the U.S. chapter of the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society is kicking off its spring series of single malt extravaganzas. The kickoff was this past week in New York City, and I caught up with U.S. chapter president Alan Shane.
We're just starting our 18th year of it. Starting it off this time in New York City, where we originally began.
What's the schedule for the spring?
Oh, it's pretty hectic. Next week on Thursday, we're going to be in Phoenix. Then the following week, we're in Atlanta on a Wednesday. 2 days later, we're in Seattle on April 1st. Houston and Dallas around the middle of April. And then we finish up in Colorado on the 15th of May.
Do these get bigger every year?
Yes, they did. You know, we've been very, very fortunate. They've been growing every year since we started. I remember the first one we did here in New York, we probably had about 40 or 50 people all together. But it was a great group, and everybody enjoyed it, and we didn't have as many different offerings of whiskey. Back then, I think if we had 20 or 25, it was a lot. This year, I believe we have close to 110.
By the way, if you use the discount code WC11 at the Society's website, you can order two tickets at the Society members' price. While I was at the extravaganza the other night, I ran into Diageo's Evan Catnack. A couple of weeks ago, I mentioned that Evan has been honored with Lifetime Achievement Awards from both Malt Advocate Magazine and Whiskey Magazine's Icons of Whiskey Awards.
Evan, tell me your thoughts, because I don't think anybody's ever gotten Lifetime Achievement Awards from both Malt Advocate and Whiskey Magazine in the same year ever before.
No, well, I was blown away. I went over to London on the understanding that I was going to pick up one for the Masters of Whiskey, an award for them. And I was sitting sort of enjoying myself and waiting for it. It passed and thought, that's strange. Oh, well, anyway, I'm enjoying myself. And then all of a sudden, he started reading out a biography, and I thought, oh, my God, that's me. And every word went out of me. I just choked up. It was so, so moved. It was fabulous, fabulous award. And then, of course, to find I'm getting one up in Chicago as well from the Malt Advocate, and, you know... It's very unusual, very unusual. And I am so honored to have been honored by both of them. And, I love what I do. As I said in London, and as all I could say in London was, this hasn't been work, it's just been pleasure. And that was all I could say. I was just choked up with it. And it was so emotional. You know, standing ovation by everybody that was there. Went on for ages. And, oh, gosh. It was beautiful, beautiful. Yeah, I love what I do. And that's it. And right enough, this is not work. This is so much enjoyment all the time. Speaking to people that love Scotch whiskies. And I'm so glad now there are so many other ambassadors around the world talking about great whiskies.
And what do you do to top this now?
Oh, well, no. There's just nothing that can top this now. And it's just great, really, altogether. I had an award way back in the early 90s from Chicago Exposition, and I thought, that's wonderful. Never expecting this to appear. You know, this is my 50th year. It's a great year. I've been working with Diageo and all the classic malts, and I've loved every minute of it.
How long are you going to keep going?
Yeah, I'll keep going as long as they want me to keep going. And it's not finished because my son Gregor is coming back to work in the States as well. So the line has been continued.
And your youngest son will be doing it eventually too, right?
I hope so, yes. In fact, he's got quite a good nose just now. I was nosing a Kalila from 100% old bourbon casks. And, of course, it had nice vanilla and smoky notes. And I handed the glass to him and I said, smell that. He said, smoky ice cream. So, he's got quite a nose on him. Yeah.
Smart kid you got there. How old is he now?
10. He'll be 10 on Sunday. He'll be 10 on Sunday, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Still a few years before you let him taste, though, right?
Yeah. Oh, yes, a long, long time. Another 11 years. Unless he goes to Scotland, and then it'll be only another 8 years.
And happy birthday to young Robert Katanak this weekend. Finally, the winners of the Ultimate Spirits Challenge have been announced. F. Paul Packholt heads the judging panel for the competition, which saw judges tasting spirits side-by-side in New York City earlier this month. Chairman's Trophy Awards went to Buffalo Trace's George T. Stagg Bourbon and Sazerac 18-Year-Old Rye for U.S. whiskies. In the Scotch categories, Aberlour Abuna won the Chairman's Trophy for Cask Strength Single Malts. The Balvenie 17-Year-Old Peated Cask won for Speyside Malts, the Highland Park 18 for Island Malts. Separately, Lagavulin's Distiller's Edition won for Isla Malts, and Dewar's 18 won the Chairman's Trophy for Best Blended Scotch. Michael Collins won the Chairman's Trophy for Best Blended Irish Whiskey, while the Tyrconnell Madeira finish took top honors for Irish Single Malts. Finally, Canadian Mist Black Diamond won the Chairman's Trophy for Best Canadian Whiskey. And that's the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. Unnecessarily well-made. St. Patrick's Day was this past week, and I had a chance to pull pints of Guinness with master brewer Fergal Murray at the Ulysses Folkhouse Pub in New York City. Tapping beer kegs has never been one of my strong suits, but under Fergal's guidance, I managed to get it right on the first try. You can get the same lesson in the first video version of WhiskeyCast. It's available on YouTube, and there's a link at the WhiskeyCast website, too. Got some quick reaction to the video after it hit YouTube, and the emails of the week are brought to you this time around by the Singleton of Glendullen. Nate Breeze emailed this note, "It's great to have a face with a voice now. Congratulations on an excellent entry into the world of video. The Guinness pouring lesson was interesting. Perhaps you could follow up with a tasting session with a colorful character from the world of whiskey. A whiskey nosing class from a few months ago would have been interesting to see as well. I generally listen to the podcast on the go, so the video is not something I've been missing. I hope you'll consider it an enhancement rather than a replacement. The weekly podcast is truly excellent and very much appreciated. Enjoy Taiwan. Cheers, Nate." Mark Dermal posted this on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page. "Mark, this is brilliant. A great addition to what you already put out. Don't replace the cast, though. I listen to this while commuting." "Don't worry. I have no plans to switch to a video version full-time. It's something I'll do occasionally when there's a story that makes better sense to tell with video." Finally, Gene Fisher emailed a question. "Mark, can you explain the designation straight applied to some rye whiskey and bourbon whiskey? Is there a difference between, say, straight rye whiskey and rye whiskey not designated as straight? Thanks and keep those great podcasts coming. Yours truly, Gene." Well, the answer is found in U.S. federal regulations, which mandate that any bourbon, rye, wheat, or malt whiskey made in the U.S. that's aged for at least 2 full years be labeled as straight whiskey. That way you can tell matured whiskeys from those aged less than 2 years, even if the whiskey doesn't carry an age statement. If you have a question or a suggestion, my email address is comments@whiskeycast.com, and you can also use the WhiskeyCast Facebook page, too. The emails of the week are brought to you by the Singleton of Glendullen, 12-year-old Speyside single malt scotch whiskey, aged in both American bourbon oak and European sherry oak casks. Time now to check out the calendar of events brought to you for the fourth consecutive year by our friends at Laphroaig. This coming weekend is the Whiskies of the World Expo in San Francisco, along with Whiskey Messe in Vienna, Whiskey Ship in Luzern, Switzerland, and the Whiskey Festival Nordnederland in Groningen. As I mentioned earlier, Whiskey Live New York is April 6th. Whiskey Week in Chicago is the following week. Highlights include the annual Binney's World of Whiskies event April 14th, Malt Advocates Whiskey Fest Chicago is April 15th, and Ardbeg has announced its U.S. Ardbeg Committee Summit will be held in Chicago on April 16th. By the way, ticket sales begin April 4th for the Spirit of Toronto Festival on May 14th, and the Spirit of Speyside Festival is April 28th through May 2nd in and around Dufton, Scotland. You'll find a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig. Just click the Laphroaig banner at the WhiskeyCast website to become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla. Edinburgh is not only the capital of Scotland, but the main tourist center as well. While I was in Edinburgh last week for the Gordon and MacPhail Glenlivet 70 launch, I took some time to look around at some of the places that whiskey lovers are most likely to search out. That includes Royal Mile Whiskies, which just won Whiskey Magazine's Icons of Whiskey Award for multiple outlet retailers. Keir Sword is one of Royal Mile's owners.
You know, it's the staff that win that award. We've got a great bunch of guys working for us, and they've won the award on a number of years, and we're all delighted by it.
Tell me about the philosophy you have at the store.
The philosophy is that we will provide as wide a range of whiskies as possible to the expertise. You know, we try and ensure that our staff are all enthusiasts about whiskey. They don't need to know a huge amount of about whiskey when they join us, as long as they have the enthusiasm to learn and the will to learn. And that is behind what we do. You know, it's all based on enthusiasm about whiskey.
Tell me how you teach them.
There's only one way you can really learn about whiskey, and that's tasting it. We do a lot of tasting. There's a staff tasting program that we do. We try and do it generally in the busier months. We struggle to do it every week, but we try and sit down every so often and have a tasting of all the new products.
At the Royal Mile store, is the audience of customers your market mostly tourists, or is it locals, or is it a mix of both?
Definitely a mix of both. When we took over in 1997, it was very much a case that, you know, we were a tourist shop. We immediately tried to change that. The barrier that we've come up against is the fact that we are on the Royal Mile and we sell a Scottish product. So still to this day, 14, 15 years on, we still get people coming in and saying, we've never been in the shop before because we assumed it was a expensive tourist place. But so we're slowly but surely converting the locals. But in the summer, obviously, the tourism is our real mainstay. That's when we are at our busiest, and it's because of the tourists.
Give me a sense of the range of whiskies you carry, because I know at the low end you carry miniatures from most of the distilleries, but you also carry some American whiskies as well, including the Mellow Corn from Heaven Hill that I saw in the shop yesterday that was featured in Ian Buxton's 101 Whiskies to Try Before You Die book. But give me a sense of the whiskey, of the range of whiskies you carry.
We carry as wide a range as we can. Generally, there are so many whiskies from independent bottlers, we can't stock them all, but invariably we try and choose the best offerings from independent bottlers. We often find that, the ones that we haven't selected, our customers then start asking for, so we've got to add them in. But internationally, we carry whiskies, as you mentioned, the Mellow Corn. We do a lot of American whiskies. We do a lot of, the established whiskies, the Irish and the Japanese. But we always try and, find new things, find things that are harder to find in the UK, and, build on that. So I believe we were the first place in the world ever to sell Swedish whiskey with the McMira. We beat the System Bulleget by a few days because we were selling at Whiskey Live that year. But we're always looking for something new.
How do you decide what to carry?
Generally, we try and carry as much of the proprietary brands as possible, and the proprietary bottlings. From the independent bottlers, it's a bit more selective and trying to pick up. The doing on tastings and finding which are their best casks that they've got at the time. But as I said, that doesn't always work because, invariably there will be customers ask for something that we haven't selected initially. So,
now you expanded past the Royal Mile down all the way to London recently. What went into that decision?
That was quite a few years ago. Now, it was basically the decision behind London was all the stuff that we sold went out the front door of that little shop on the Royal Mile. We were expanding the internet side of things. We were growing a lot more, and all the parcels went out that front door. All the stock went in that door and right out the door. It's the only door we've got. So we decided we needed somewhere else to dispatch from. It was either getting a warehouse or getting another shop, and we figured at that point on another shop. We've since got a warehouse as well, though. So,
how much mail order do you do?
It's growing. It's effectively the size of a shop to us. We really consider it the fact that at the moment we've got three whiskey shops. We've got one in London, one in Edinburgh, and the internet.
How much of that accounts for your business, and how much of it, I assume you will ship overseas to countries we will not name for legal reasons, since we're in Scotland, of course we can say that, but you do ship pretty much anywhere, right?
No, there are some markets we can't ship to. We're finding at the moment that the European Union is the hardest market to crack. We currently can't send to Germany. Sweden, which was historically a great market for us, we're having to charge UK duty, we charge UK duty on everything, but we're also having to charge Swedish duty, which we think is very unfair on the customer, but to date we haven't found a way around it. We're meant to be able to claim back the UK duty on anything it's sent out of the UK, but the bureaucracy involved in claiming it back, it's set up for people sending containers of whiskey. We're sending parcels. We're not in the container market or even pallet market for that matter.
What's the biggest obstacle you face in that?
In claiming the duty back?
In sending overseas?
Just dealing with so many different, different bureaucracies. It's bad enough. We have the challenge of the UK duty issue, but every market we send to, we've got to handle the bureaucracy there as well.
How badly were you affected by the recession?
The recession hasn't been too harsh on us as yet. I'm still always quite nervous about that. I was just watching the news before I came down there, and it's all doom and gloom about the recession again on the news, and I'm wary of the fact that we are not totally recession proof, and at some point we will take a hit, but at the moment, fingers crossed, we haven't been too badly hit.
Are you having fun?
Having great fun, yeah. Yeah, we love what we do. Work with a great bunch of guys and with a great product, yeah. So,
what's the future hold? Do you see other stores in the future, or what are your plans?
Yeah, we have one other store opening very soon. It will be called The Drinkmonger rather than Roma Whiskies. We found that with the name Whiskies in our title, we found that people don't realise that we sell a wide range of rums, wide range of gins and such like. And for us to expand, we reckon that we need to get into the more competitive side of things with wine. So we will be opening a general drink store, which will be in Pitlochry, called The Drinkmonger, and we're just going through the planning of that at the moment.
When will that happen?
It depends on, again, we were talking about bureaucracy a minute ago, it depends on the bureaucracy. We're currently working for planning permission, because we're going to be changing the shop, and we're currently working for licensing, change of the operating plan of the shop. The shop already has a license. So it's one of these things that you can't get the licensing approval to get the planning permission approval. And so we're currently dealing with that challenge. But once we get over that, it should hopefully be open by early May.
The only distillery left in Edinburgh is the North British Grain Whiskey Distillery, which is not open for tours. Glenkinchie is the nearest single malt distillery. It's about half an hour or so east of the city. The next best thing is the Scotch Whiskey Experience. It's located at the top of the Royal Mile, a couple of blocks uphill from Royal Mile Whiskies. Last September, I visited the experience for the first time back in episode 278. But there have been even more changes since then, as Julie Hunter explained.
We've been doing some expansion downstairs in our public bar that anybody can come into, which is adjacent to Amber Restaurant. And the good news about that is it's really responding to our capacity demand, because it's a bit of feast or famine with tourism. And when we're busy, you know, we're really busy, and we frequently have queues of people waiting round about lunchtime. But also, when you're a tourist and you're on holiday, you kind of, your usual patterns of eating and drinking go a little bit awry. So we often have people coming quite late afternoon, you know, looking for a snack. So we've decided that in addition to having a bit more capacity, we this summer, when the season really picks up, we're going to have a really informal type of dining for people that'll last kind of right from lunchtime all the way through till about 7 or 8 o'clock in the evening, and then maybe a bit more formal dining thereafter. So when people come in maybe 4, 5, 6 o'clock, maybe not wanting a full meal, but maybe platters of nice Scottish smoked fish, or a bowl of mussels, or some Scottish cheeses, or a mixture of different Scottish canapés and tapas and that type of thing. So that sort of food, very traditional and a great match to Scotch whisky. So that's our ambition, is to do that over the summer. But to kick that off in May, we plan to do a whisky and food matching item every day, and every day do something different, which will be a bit of a challenge to the chef, I think. He's said he's up for it. You know, obviously, as the spring and the summer food comes around, we've got a really fabulous larder available to us at that time of year. So it's a nice time to do it. And we'll be picking a different whisky and food matching. We want to do something quite interesting online as well, to get people to give us their own opinions. Obviously, with whisky, everybody's palate's different, and you double that up when you do whisky and food. I mean, there's some great winning combinations that almost everyone agrees are good and work together. But you know, aside from that, you have lots of differences in opinion as to what people like and what they don't like. So we're hoping to begin really a nice conversation, not just in the world of real whisky enthusiasts, but beginning to get people that are sort of novices as well, perhaps interested in whisky through the medium of Scottish food. So they might come in here for a bite to eat, and we've saying, gosh, you know, you're tasting that, why don't you try it alongside this dram, because they work brilliantly together. So using the food as a vehicle to get people excited about Scotch as well.
And really trying to grow the audience, because that's where what the goal of the experience is to try to build the audience for Scotch whisky out there, right?
That's right. I mean, we get a lot of people coming in here that take the sort of experience of our whisky tour, because we're in Scotland, we're maybe just in Edinburgh for a few days, we don't have time to travel extensively, and we're just going to do Scotch. We don't know anything about it, but you know, we can't come to Scotland and not do something to do with Scotch. So we're really lucky, we get a lot of people that are kind of ripe for conversion, for us to talk to them about the wonders of Scotch whisky. But obviously, using the restaurant and Scottish food, and there's such a lovely synergy between Scotch whisky and its landscape and the foods that are produced locally. And so using people that maybe would look at the attraction and say, you know, whisky isn't for me, but we'll go in because we'll get a lovely lunch and some really nice Scottish food. Already they have that level of interest in Scotland and its landscapes. And so that's an additional audience, even for us here, that we can find some synergies of getting them to enjoy a dram of whisky.
Now, is this the final step in the remodeling and the refurbishment that we've talked about for a couple of years that's been going on here at the Experience?
There's never a final step. We always have aspirations. In fact, we're talking about revamping our retail experience next year. That's hopefully our next step, and that's the last big thing on the calendar. But we've just also taken on quite a big new project looking after the Scotland Whisky Partnership and Network, whose consumer face is scotlandwhisky.com. So that's been quite another sort of big task for us to take on. So there's four of us here that are sort of sharing that between us and managing to squeeze it in with the rest of our workload too.
And let's explain the heritage of that, because that's been going on for several years. It was a partnership that Visit Scotland started out with at one point and was getting some public funding from the Scottish government, and that's drying up now for economic reasons. So the industry is sort of taking this on now, right?
Right, well, it was originally both funded and supported by public and private sector, which was great. So through the Scotch Whisky Association and through ourselves, from the whisky side of things, and then through Visit Scotland and also Scottish Enterprise as government bodies, all worked together incredibly well. And the project was taken forward by one person who led it, Chris Conway, for a number of years. The funding was going to be 3 years, and it was extended because it's been so successful. It's a great website and really draws people into tourism in Scotland through an interest in Scotch whisky. But, you know, eventually the day had to come when, you know, would you either have to be sustainable or not? So we decided that rather than letting this fantastic work that had happened and was doing so incredibly well go to waste, that we would take it over and see if we can make it really, you know, work commercially and just sort of pay for itself as an activity. So we're now operating it from Scotch Whisky Experience, keeping that connection of all the Scotch Whisky embassies, which are the hotels, the bars, the restaurants throughout Scotland, who have a commitment and a passion for Scotch whisky. Pulling together them with the distilleries that offer visitors facilities and that you can go along and visit, and also all the whisky festivals as well, and with a handful of tour operators that do anything from day tours that you can go on to private events, to bespoke planning for a small group or a family. So, you know, any kind of tour operator is pulled into that as well. So there's an opportunity for people to engage with Scotch whisky as a tourism product in Scotland on lots of different levels and have a really nice seamless experience.
How big is the market for tourism in Scotland? I know that it has been growing recently, and you're getting more and more not just whisky tourists, but tourists of all stripes that come to visit.
You know, that's right. It really has been growing, and you're looking at, I mean, £4 million is what the market was seen as until last year. And last year, they finally managed to do some new statistics and pull in all the day trip market, because obviously within Scotland there's lots of tourism too. And that figure suddenly leapt to £11 million. So it's a big, big market for Scotland. So when you combine tourism and whisky, you know, gosh, that's really what Scotland's about, those two things together. Lots of different strands that pull people into Scotland. Its history, its heritage, obviously the natural side of the country. Golf is a key one. But whisky is always going to be a key thing for Scotland. And, you know, it's nice to see in all the sort of plans that the tourism agency has, Visit Scotland have for moving forward, that Scotch whisky is becoming a stronger and stronger part of that and more integral part of it, which is great.
Where does the Scotland Whisky website go from here? Because I know that you're working on a redesign. When will it be ready for people to start looking at, and what will it include? I know that Chris's original site had that great malt whisky bars map of Scotland that you could find especially for Glasgow and Edinburgh. But what else will it have available for people who are interested?
I think the main thing that we want to do is, you know, like with all websites, have a little look at the navigation of how it sits and everything, because the way they use the web now, you know, it changes so quickly. And so we just need to look at better navigation throughout it. But I think it's pretty simple, actually. I think really what we aspire to do is put more content on it to encourage us to have a more active relationship with all the hotels that are involved in it, the bars and the restaurants, encourage them to put together more special events and more products. And this would be the perfect vehicle for us to then be able to communicate that to people. So I think it's more about just getting that sort of content of whisky tourism out to people. So saying to them, you know, here's a fantastic package that's available through June at this, you know, special hotel. If you go there, you'll also be taken to the distillery. You'll have a special experience one evening, a sort of one-off tasting with one of the local experts. You're putting things together that people can just buy into, and it will be a bit of a one-off and something special, so that they can use it a bit as a calendar of what's on and what special things are happening if they happen to be visiting Scotland.
Give me a sense of what's special and what's happening this year, besides what we know is always a tradition, the Spirit of Speyside Festival in early May, the Fae Gael in Islay at the end of May. What else is happening in Scotland this year, whisky-wise, that people should know about?
I think these are always going to be the cornerstones of what we're looking at, and certainly the distilleries are beginning to expand their season a little bit. So there's a couple of Speyside distilleries that are opening now, you know, earlier in the season rather than waiting until Easter, which is fantastic. Because you know, lots of visitors are still, that the season for Scotland's getting much longer. So we're seeing sort of much, much better opportunity for people to visit the distilleries out with the key summer season, which is great, because lots of people, the distilleries offer already, you know, a great range of different tours. You know, for example, you look at Glengoyne Distillery, you have there about five or, you know, four or five different types of tours, from the basic one way up to, you know, the most in-depth experience you could have. And so I think a lot of products already exist for people, but expanding and extending the season a little bit, I think, is really key. And that's beginning to happen bit by bit. No other sort of really major and big events on the horizon that I'm aware of, but there is worth keeping an eye out there, because there is definitely a desire through the whisky industry and also through Visit Scotland to get that out to market, to begin to sort of promote more. And I think what you also will see now, as a for sure, is all the other big Scottish events, the Highland Games, any events that you come to throughout the year, that the food and drink offering at those is of a much more exciting quality and diversity than it has been in years gone by for people. So that's something that's changed a lot in the last year. Focusing on Scotland's year of food and drink, is that any of the big events that happen, there's a lot more of the local suppliers, the local distillers coming along and attending them. So much more of an integration of Scotch whisky into, you know, lots of other cultural parts of what's going on.
And I know we're seeing more distilleries that are holding open days for the public. I know Springbank has its coming up down in Campbelltown in May. I know that Erin has one in La Crenza out on the island, and Auchintoshan will be having one in May or June near Glasgow. But we're seeing a lot more of these open days where the community is welcomed into the distillery as well as visitors, right?
That's right. And I think, you know, often these things maybe happen for a specific anniversary and are so successful. And Not even just commercially successful, but they're seen as this sort of lovely relationship building thing, as you say, with the local community, that that once it's happened once, maybe for 175th anniversary or something, let's do this. And they're like, that can't be the last time we do that. You know, it was just so successful, a nice sense of community, great relationships built that then want to be maintained and, you know, then become, you know, potentially annual events. So that I think we'll see happening, you know, more and more throughout the year, which is great in terms of providing something and something unique and different, we would like to think, whenever you happen to come to Scotland.
In addition to the bars at the experience, there are several other good whisky bars in Edinburgh, but my new favorite is a few blocks off the Royal Mile on the other side of Edinburgh Castle. While I was in Edinburgh, I stayed at the Caledonian Hilton. It's known around town as the Cali. It's been an Edinburgh landmark for decades. And the Cali Bar is worthy of landmark status, with a wall full of more than 250 different whiskies. Ben Walker is the Cali's bar manager.
Well, it started when Felix Bush, the old food and beverage manager, who, like myself, adored whisky, wanted to create a unique concept for a hotel within Edinburgh. And what more than you in Scotland, capital of Edinburgh, come up with a whisky bar with a selection of approximately 250 single malts and a total 280 whiskies, varying from Japan, Canada. We even have Amrut from India. And it was just to give guests who were staying in the hotel a concept to experience the history of Scotland within a residential place that they don't need to venture from, especially with the Scottish weather. What more do you want? Sit in a really comfortable surrounding, nice comfy armchairs, and have some whiskey.
But your clientele is also locals too, right?
Yes. They are locals. They have come in, they've heard about us and our selection of whiskies and want to experience what we have here, especially with the range of whiskey flights that we have. We have a fantastic range. We start with the introduction to malt whiskies, which is a selection of each of the areas, to the robust malts of Islay. In that, it includes the Lagavulin, the Kalila. Then we also have a stroll through Speyside, which, as it says, is a tour of the Speyside distilleries. So, and then we have the classic malts, which are part of the Diageo range, and they're the Lagavulin, Talisker, Craganmore, Dalwhinnie, Glenkinchie, and Oban. And so we have a fantastic variation, and we are always updating them. And I myself, I'm looking into creating different ones that will appeal to everyone.
How did you select the whiskies, or how do you select the whiskies that go up here? Because you don't have every single distillery represented in Scotland, but you're pretty close, right?
Yes, we are very close. A couple of the distilleries we don't have. We don't have Dartmill, we don't have Tam na Vuolan. It was selected by Felix Bush, and we have been developing it from then. And he selected the ones that he liked, and also the very popular ones as well, such as Ardbeg, Talisker, ones that you could get locally, and also ones that are just UK export only and really exclusive to Scotland. And also, for example, we have our own labelling whisky, which currently is with Tully Bardeen. And that label is for the hotel. It mentions a whisky, and it is available throughout the hotel. So we just wanted a unique concept with the whiskies, and I don't think the bar would be big enough to have every single distillery or every single whiskey available. So we had to select a certain amount, and we are still hoping to increase the number of whiskies and also the variation of whiskies. We want to get in maybe a smaller number of a certain distillery, but add in, for example, Tam na Vuolan, Dartmill, so to give our clientele a better variation and better tasting experience.
How do you decide what new whiskies to add in? Because with the industry producing several hundred new bottlings a year, there's got to be pressure on you to add those bottles here. How do you decide what gets in and what doesn't?
For example, a good example for this year is with the royal wedding coming up. We would like to get in a bottle of whiskey that celebrates a royal wedding. And I also discuss with the distilleries what they have available. And I read up what is in the market at the minute. It's everyone's taste varies. So we want to get in, when we get a new whiskey, something for everyone. So whether it be a very nice light one or a very robust, heavily peated one, and just see what is out there. Because with, as you mentioned, with the market as it is varied. So it's especially with people thinking they do not like whiskey, we need to educate them. We need to get them to say, okay, yes, there's a whiskey for everyone. I do have a motto here. I could sell a whiskey to anyone in 15 minutes, and there's a whiskey for everyone. So I have proved a point to that with several of my clientele who come here. They start off not liking whiskey. By the end of the night, they leave loving whiskey. So it is just what we think is popular and what we would like to offer. And any unique bottlings, because in one of the largest whiskey bars in Edinburgh, we want to have a lot more of the unique bottles. For example, we have the most expensive bottle for a bar, hotel, or restaurant within Edinburgh. It's £225 a nip, and there were only 83 bottles ever made, and you can't go to many bars in Scotland, let alone Edinburgh, and have a whiskey of that price.
And you're going to have to give me the details on that one, because you didn't say anything else about it other than its price.
It is Benromach. It was distilled in 1949 and bottled in 2004. And we have bottle number 15 of number 83. And it is a fantastic whiskey, very, very smooth. It's, for my taste, it's very similar to molasses, treacle. You get the woodiness from it. You get the finish. The finish is spectacular. It is such a smooth finish, no harsh overtones. And it is just a unique whiskey that we will be sad to sell the final shot of, but it's like a fantastic selling point.
It's fair to say also that you only have one shot left, right?
Yes. And I have tried it, and I did enjoy it. And we have had the bottle for just over 2 years, and we do want to get rid of the final shot. As I said, we will be sad to miss a bottle, but it's like we want our guests to have the best tasting experience possible. And having the final shot of a bottle of whiskey that is unavailable to purchase anymore, what more could someone want?
But let's also take this back down, because not all of your drams, obviously, are in that range. You have accessible drams that anyone can enjoy at virtually any price, correct?
Our single malts start from £5 upwards, which is, we are the slightly larger measures. We are the 35mm measures, which is more of the Irish side. So I say you get better value for money. And with my whiskey knowledge and developing my team's whiskey knowledge, we will send our guests through a journey of whiskey tasting. And there is a whiskey in a price range for everyone. I myself prefer the lower end. One of my favourites is the Strath Isla 30-year-old, which we sell at £12.50. I think that's a bargain, as I have a 32-year-old Macallan at £165. But that Strath Isla is beautiful, very smooth, very easy drinking, and never had anyone turn it back. Also, another favourite of mine is the Boonahaven, which the 12-year, £5 a nip. And if you are looking for more of the blended whiskies, our famous Scrouse, which is our house whiskey, starts at £4.50. So there is a price for everyone.
How much education do you have to do? Because you're dealing with a tourist clientele here, with people coming in from outside Edinburgh. How much education is necessary?
A lot of education is necessary. I have worked in hospitality for the past 11 years. I love this industry, and I know I don't say Scottish, but my family is Scottish. My grandfather had a lot of dealings with whiskey, and I've worked at the three largest whiskey bars in Edinburgh. And a lot of clientele that I get in here don't really understand whiskey. So I'm still developing my knowledge, but I like to educate my clientele further to give them the best knowledge that they want. They're more than welcome to come in and have the whiskey that they always drink, but I always recommend a whiskey that they either haven't had before or can't get back at home, because with, as I mentioned, the selection of 250, there is a whiskey for everyone.
Now, Ben was kind enough to let me taste that 30-year-old Strath Isla he was talking about. Let's start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with it. It's from Gordon and MacPhail, distilled in 1977, bottled at 43% ABV. The nose is full of butterscotch, honey, and a touch of toffee. The taste is tart and tangy, with pineapple, coconut, and a touch of cinnamon that fades to reveal some honey sweetness. The finish is lingering and soft with honey and coconut notes. I'm scoring it a 91. While I was at the Cali Bar, fellow malt maniac Serge Valentin insisted I try the 1971 Spey Malt from Macallan. Again, a Gordon and MacPhail 2010 bottling at 43% ABV, around 39 years old. The nose has excellent notes of figs, toffee, brown sugar, and almonds. The taste is mouth-puckering, with Christmas cake, orange peel, roasted almonds, brown sugar, and honey underneath to give it a great balance. The finish is sweet, long, honeyed, and amazing. It's a whopper of a whiskey. I'm scoring the 1971 Spey Malt from Macallan a 97. Got to thank Serge again for that experience. Let's come back down to earth now. I mentioned the Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey earlier. I am not usually a fan of whiskey liqueurs, but this one does have some good points to it. It's bottled at 40% ABV. The nose is muted with sweet honey, nectar, honey-glazed ham, and a touch of burnt leaves. The taste has honey and orange notes with a bit of cayenne pepper, and the finish is light and subtle with hints of raspberry jam and hazelnut coffee. Now for the weak point. I couldn't taste any of the traditional Jack Daniel's notes in it, or any whiskey at all for that matter. The whiskey notes are overwhelmed by the liqueur. That makes it easy to drink, but also means it can sneak up on you. Because of that, I'm giving Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey an 83. You'll find my tasting notes in the free WhiskeyCast apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android. The iPhone and iPad version is sponsored by the Glenrothes, and the Android version is sponsored by Ben Romick. You can also find them at the WhiskeyCast website. That's also where you'll find the calendar of events, links to the WhiskeyCast Facebook page, and my Twitter feed, the WhiskeyCast store, powered by Amazon.com, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is www.whiskeycast.com, and my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2011, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.